Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Alrighty, guys, we're going live. 3, 2, closing door in the office. And one.
That, ladies and gentlemen, was Peter Sage. My name is Marius Auge, and this is the Captara podcast coming out of Oslo, Norway. Hello and welcome to another episode of the podcast, edition 68. And this episode is in English, as today's guest is an Englishman. Or at least he was born there, but now he's a man of the world and as far as I know, have lived and traveled all over. The form of this podcast is always a conversation with a guest, more maybe than an interview. And usually these conversations are centered around life as a runner. Or life with running. But as my usual listeners know, we always go long distance and the topics vary from the physical to the mental and sometimes into spiritual and metaphysical matters. The introduction to the guest is usually short and free in form, and I just do that based on my notes, but today is a little different as I've written everything down, and that is because I feel the need to give a little context. Some of you may know Peter as the teacher, trainer, and mentor is, but most of you probably won't even have heard of him. So a little introduction is in its place. With Peter, I could have talked a lot about running. He has run marathons. He's even run marathons for charity in large, heavy costumes. And eventually, he finished the Marathon des Sables, a 250-kilometer stage race through the desert in Morocco, also known as the Sahara. He has climbed tall mountains and is an experienced skydiver, and we could have talked training as he works out every day and has a great physique. He has a gym in his house, and as we mentioned very briefly, he's going to row across the Atlantic Ocean next year. That is wild. I will link to these things mentioned in the podcast notes. We could also have talked nutrition. And health, and other topics concerning specific habits that will make us more productive. But where Peter shines and has his expertise is mentoring and coaching people on their way to self-mastery and their full potential as individuals within the collective of other humans that we all spend a big part of our lives. Peter is probably the most authentic person I ever came across, and he has the positive mindset and integrity of someone who walks his talk every day. So, what led me to Peter's mansion in Tenerife to celebrate his 50th birthday with about 200 other guests? A man that is a serial entrepreneur and renowned speaker, 6 times TEDx, and has been booked to share the stage with high-profile people such as Sir Richard Branson, Kofi Annan, and former US President Bill Clinton. Okay, I will try to make a long story short, but for me, it started last year after an especially dark period. I had been working for years, part-time freelancing, part-time for a small company in a very demanding role that was extremely stressful for me. And I felt that I was going in a direction where I wasn't the captain of my ship, and that I was at the mercy of others. I had trouble sleeping, and I was in a state of fear where I had no tools to help me, and I didn't know where to find them either. I had a strong sensation that I had inner work to do, but didn't know what that consisted of. I had read a lot of books, but hadn't really asked myself the unpleasant questions. There was at times feelings of despair, and after the pandemic, it had just been amplified. So then, one day, I was let go from the company I worked in because of their financial situation, and to be honest, I was very relieved. At just about the same time, I saw Peter in a TEDx talk, and he spoke of procrastination and your nervous system, and I was sold on a webinar that I joined short after. Procrastination, I knew a lot about. There has been so many projects that I want to do over the years but didn't start, or other projects that I started but didn't finish. So I knew this was something I needed to address in my life. What Peter taught in that webinar resonated strongly with me, and I joined one of his courses that then led me to what was his main mentorship program called EMF. This was a course that required a lot more dedication. It was set up with online peer groups and partners that were there to keep us accountable. And this lasted 7 months. It was transforming. It was brilliantly crafted and contained recorded lectures from Peter that taught a lot of things that I maybe knew bits and parts of, but at this level was transforming. When we got towards the end of it, and Peter invited all the students that had finished his program to his festival and 50th birthday in Tenerife, I was fortunate enough to have the chance to join, and when he showed up in one of our Zoom calls, I got to ask him directly if I could have a talk for the podcast, and he was positive, so we got to set this up. On this one, we had an intention to go for longer on this recording, but everything took time to set up, and he also had some other engagements, so the short time is because of that, and I have decided to call this episode part one with the intention of doing another. Also, on this one, there is no video of the interview, unfortunately. I have a recording of Peter, but the one of me failed, so this is podcast only. Very rare these days where everything is basically on video. So, ladies and gentlemen, friends of the pod, enjoy the talk with Peter, and pardon my English at times. Peter Sage, welcome to the podcast.
Nice, what a pleasure to be here.
And thank you for letting me into your beautiful home to do the interview.
Well, I mean, you're on the island, I'm here, you're here. What better way to do it than in person?
Yeah, it's amazing. So we're going to do a short interview with you today, as I know time is a little bit limited. But I want you to tell me a little bit about your background, where you come from as an entrepreneur, into business, and we'll take it from there.
Right. And one of the things when I share a bit about my background, I know people ask the question because a lot of the time they're looking for, you know, what is the difference that makes the difference? And I was a normal kid. If anything, a little shy. You know, my mother brought me up. She was a very, you know, strong Catholic lady with a really big heart. And you know, she taught me manners. She taught me to be polite. And as a young kid, that kind of meant doing as you're told and sort of fitting in. My father was exactly the opposite. Yeah, he never fit in. He never made apologies. And yeah, he was his own man, very proud. So it was an interesting kind of dichotomy with the two most influential figures growing up to have those different sort of, models of the world. And I wanted to make my parents proud, as every kid does. And under the old model, that really translates to doing well at school. And so I really tried. And I'm not book smart. You know, I'm not an academic guy. I'm a practical guy. Yeah, you know, I get a PhD in results, but you know, I'd fail my high school entrance exam. You know, so yeah, for me, really, it was about finding other ways to prove myself. So, having left school at 16, you know, first chance I got, I really went out knowing that I'm not going to be able to rely on being able to compete with people that had fancy pieces of paper, yeah, you know, with certificates and signatures and names and letters and all that kind of stuff. So. And it didn't really appeal to me. My dad was a business guy. Yeah, it was kind of a solopreneur. He actually employed two people and had a junkyard, and but he was always doing deals on the side. I like that. I like this whole business, you know, entrepreneurship. It was aspirational for me. Yeah, I didn't get turned on. I didn't get jazzed by, oh, well, if you work hard enough for the next 5 years, you'll make manager. And if you work hard enough for the next 5 years, you'll make senior manager. Maybe one day you'll be department head. That'd put me to sleep with, you know, or make me slip my wrist. It was never going to go there. But this opportunity, this creative aspect of, you know, taking an idea and seeing if it'll work. And part of the advantage was, you know, we were never well off growing up. I mean, we never went hungry. You know, my parents worked really hard. They had a strong work ethic.
It was in England?
In England, yes. My hometown in Leicester. Very unremarkable until we got more known for winning the Premiership football. Yeah, in an amazing story. But yeah, they worked hard, and they worked hard to try to provide for, you know, the unit. I'm an only child. There was a theory about being spoiled. I can say it's a myth. And I really was just trying to make the best of what I could in the world. One thing that did make a massive shift to me, and that was personal growth.
Yeah.
It was a divine moment in my life. I remember I met a guy in a bar. We got chatting. He was one of those things I wanted to be, an entrepreneur.
You were young at the time?
I was 17.
17, yeah.
He was super old. He was like 22. And which is 17, that's like nearly, you know, it's almost a, you know, fifth of your life, you know, more, you know. And yeah, for me, I was captivated by this guy because he didn't have a paycheck. He didn't have somebody on Friday giving him a, you know, money. He had to make it on his own. I was like, wow, I was listening to every word out of this guy's mouth as if it was gospel. And he says, I see something in you, young man, that I saw when I was your age. I mean, the guy was early 20s, right? But I was like, and he said, I'm going to drop something in behind the bar and tomorrow. And it was a set of Nightingale Conan 6 audio cassettes. And I still to this day can't remember which one it was. I'd love to go back and listen to them. But it was kind of like The Psychology of Success. And it was a live recording of a seminar of somebody teaching success.
Kind of self-help.
Yeah, totally. Personal growth.
Yeah.
But I thought, hang on a minute. Somebody's teaching success. I thought the only way to do that was someone was to teach math or chemistry or sociology or history. And then you get good at that. And then you go get a job. And then you go to try to be successful. Well, they're cutting all of this middle stuff out of the way that really doesn't seem to make sense to me. And just teaching you how to be successful. That's amazing. I need to know more. And I remember sitting night after night with my little foam headphones, you know, over my head and this little pop-up cassette recorder and my little notebook. It was smaller than my hand and a little pen, one of those free pens you get in like the catalog shops. And just writing, fascinated, all of these copious notes and reading them and finally believing it was actually possible to have nothing and create success. Now, in those days, to anyone in their pre-20s, early 20s, success means money because you identify material success with what society calls success.
Yeah, it's the status. Well, yeah.
I've since learned.
Yeah.
Fortunately, earlier than most, that a life chasing success is not the same as a life chasing fulfillment. But that was how I started. I realized I had nothing to lose, which is a really powerful place to be. And some people say, oh, I've hit rock bottom. I'm like, brilliant. So what do you mean? It says, well, you can't go any further.
Nothing to lose.
It may be harder to bounce if you're hitting concrete, but at least you can't go deeper.
Do you remember what themes resonated with you in those tapes or the kind of message? Was there like a message?
One was something which I teach to this day, which I never really heard anywhere else. The law of conformity.
The law of conformity. Tell me about that.
Stood out. I remember listening to it on that tape. And it was talking about how 5% of people in the world own the world. And you need to hang around with successful people. And it was literally that much was covered on it. And that law of conformity. You conform. I think I had to look up the word in dictionaries. This is pre-internet, yeah? And I'm like, the law of conforming, you'll conform. You'll become who you hang with was another way of saying it. It wasn't phrased that way. I, as you know, the backbone of my work is to take complex or
or stuff that's profound but glossed over, and deepen it in simple ways to understand so people can get the meaning and the benefit of being able to commit to a philosophy or a technique or a skill or an insight that will allow them to change their life. But for me, I meant the law of conformity, the 5% law. And I remember a very good friend of mine, his name was Steph, still a good friend to this day. And he had a different start in life. His mother was very successful. She owned a nightclub. And at 17, of course, where do you go? Or 16, you can't get into other nightclubs. But you know, if your mum owns one, the bouncers aren't going to ask for your ID. So we were always playing big man on campus, or little man on a big campus, as it were. But she was a wealthy woman, comparatively. And so Steph had a different lifestyle. They lived in a beautiful big home. He got a Ford Escort XR3i for his 17th birthday.
Whoa, that's a great car at the time.
At the time, it was the car. Yeah, for kids, it was like so aspirational. For his 17th birthday, with a private number plate. He was wearing Jaeger and Armani, right? Stuff that I would only see in catalogs. And there was no real hunger. And I remember having the conversation. I was explaining this stuff to him. He's like, get no hunger. And he's like, I said, Steph, you don't get it. He says, I said, you're in the 5%. I want to get there. And this is what I'm going to buy more of these tapes. I'm going to, on one of the tapes, they recommend a book. I'm going to get the book. In those days, I had to go to the public library to order it. And 3 weeks later, they might have it and send me a letter in the post to tell me that the book was there. And I'd be able to go and take it out for like £1 for 28 days. But I was on a mission. It was a mission to absorb the knowledge that I thought that I wanted to get or needed to get in order to move to the next level in my life. Now, at that point, there was skills to learn, but it was more psychology. I started to realize that people who had all the advantages, people like Steph, who I love dearly and has since gone on to become successful and been an entrepreneur up and down, which I totally respect and adore. But people that have none of the so-called advantages, education, money, country club memberships to hang around with, went and created magic. And I remember listening to, I think it might have been Denzel Washington, go through a generational progression that was so profound. It says, grandfather had nothing. And I was talking to my students yesterday. When you get used to having nothing, you normalize it as a baseline. That is fatal to success and fulfillment. Because, I've never had anything. I don't really have any aspiration to have anything, because now baseline is normal. Like most people do that with stress. They do it in relationships that are unfulfilling. I'm miserable, but that's just the way it is. Because I was miserable yesterday. Today, my goal is to be less miserable than yesterday. Great goal. Mm.
Or it's like if you put a toad in water and turn up the heat slowly, slowly, it's not going to jump out until
exactly.
It boils. Yeah.
Yeah, your baseline gets moved. Most people do it with sleep. Most people's cortisol baseline is elevated to what it normally would be. That's why they take their vacation and feel finally relaxed, apart from the last 2 days when they're dreading going back. But when you finally renormalize, you realize what normal is, and it isn't what you've been settling for that you were convincing yourself was normal. Again, another classic relationship example is relationships. If you're in an unfulfilling relationship that you're scared to lose, scared to walk away from, because you'd rather trade certainty for an unhappiness for unfulfillment, but potentially being and unfulfillment for potentially being fulfilled, but maybe alone. But when you finally listen to what your friends have been telling you for years and leave the idiot that you've been with, the amount of people that I know, that you know, that people listening and watching know, that have turned around and said, oh my God, why didn't I do that years ago?
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about certainty, because you have some great philosophy around that. Let's say a man, middle-aged, got a great job, good income, good house, two kids and a wife, everything in order, right? But at some point, everything just feels too stable. That's about certainty, right? You know that the paycheck is going to come in, but there's some lack that you don't feel fulfilled.
Yeah. In that scenario, there's other factors at play as well, because what is often referred to as a midlife crisis is where we cross a threshold, usually into our 40s, mm-hmm. where we realize in your 20s, you're invincible. Yeah, you know everything. No one can teach you anything. The world is your playground, all the rest of it. In your 30s, you're into your routine. You're working hard, trying to get everything. But you're still young. Most people remember when their parents turned 40, and now they see themselves there, and there's a different identity that shifts into it. And it's like you start to question for the first time the fact that you're not going to live forever. The fact that, hang on a minute, I've now designed myself into this box of social conformity and responsibility and norms, and it's not who I am. How did I get here? What happened? And you have this like shift. Do I really want this for the next 40 years? Now that I see a lot of people at 40 realize they're, for most people, it's the halfway mark. And they're like, whoa, if I've now got less days in front of me than I have behind me, that creates a different shift with your relationship to mortality. And now in your 20s, where you're going to waste so much time and effort and energy because you think it's you're going to live forever.
It's limitless at the point.
Yeah. You have a different relationship. So a lot of people start to question at that point. Do I really want this? Is this what everything I've been climbing to the top of Success Mountain, and I suddenly realize I don't like the view. So you see a lot of people there now that realize that, whoa, it's time to question. And at that point, the certainty level is, hang on, I've got a plant that's growing here of my life that's got some pretty established roots. Do I pull everything up? That's a big ask. If somebody, you've been dating somebody for 3 weeks, saying goodbye isn't a big deal. You just celebrated your 10th wedding anniversary and your second kid's third birthday. Your roots are deeper. That's a big plant to uproot. So therefore, the addiction to certainty, or the relationship to certainty versus uncertainty at that point, traps a lot of people for settling for making decisions they sometimes live to regret, or sometimes wish they had a higher ability to handle the uncertainty. I see people say, oh, I'll stay together for the sake of the kids. I mean, how often do we hear that? What are you really saying?
All the time, I guess.
Yeah. What's the truth in that? The truth is that I'm going to give my children an example to follow, because that's what we do as parents, that says, if you're in an unhappy relationship, I want you to stay unhappy for another 10 years so that you can give your kids an example of what not to do. No, you want to empower your children by giving them an example of following their truth or not settling for less. If you were coaching your kids and they were in an unhappy marriage, what would you be saying? Get out. I waited too long. No, that doesn't work anymore.
What about the unhappy job? Let's say you're in a relationship and you love your wife, you love your kids, but you have that, I want to create something for myself. As an entrepreneur, you have that experience, right?
Yeah.
Because you never worked under anyone, to put it that way. You've always been your own businesses .
The challenge there, again, is that there's a different dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you work for yourself or you work for somebody else and you're single, and you're like, listen, if I've got to sleep on my friend's couch for 3 months, if I've got to eat dog food for 3 hours, I'll handle it because my dream is more important than my need for comfort. That's a common launch pad for a lot of people that are entrepreneurs, like dating for someone for 3 weeks, you've not got a lot to lose. But if all of a sudden you say the responsibility of my actions could impact my ability to feed my kids, that's a whole different gravitas of decision-making. Here's what I found working in this industry and with thousands of people. If your conviction in what you want to do is strong enough and your family relationship is where it is, your partner will be the first person to say, listen, I'm behind you. And if we lose it, we lose it, and we'll figure it out. We'll find a way. We got friends. The kids aren't going to starve. You live in a society where your kids can't starve, right? Mm-hmm. In fact, if they get close, you'll have neighbors showing up with food.
Yeah. Or family.
There's a way.
Yeah.
If your level of uncertainty about the jump is high, your family's level of uncertainty about your jump will be high.
Because that's what you resonate.
100%. So you may have a wish to get out of this crappy job. And you may have had a dream on your vision board to one day be your own boss. But wishes and dreams don't come true. Convictions and intentions that have firm resolve with your heart and mind fully aligned have a far higher probability of coming true.
It's also about fair, right?
About?
Fair.
In what respect?
In the respect that if I quit my job, try, you know, I might fail. What will my friends say? You know, what will my family say? You know.
Oh, sorry, fair.
Fair.
Yeah, I think you said making it fair. Sorry.
Fair.
It's not fair being yourself scared. To be not in line with your truth. But when it comes to fair, of course. And again, the mind loves to label. Fear is a four-letter word that incorporates a whole lot of different things, just like love is a four-letter word that incorporates a whole lot of different things.
Can fit on your fingers there.
and that is your dichotomy. Do you want to make a decision based on love or fear? Now, the gradients of those words are almost infinite. Yeah, I love sitting here having a conversation with you. That's a different kind of love to, you know, love my dogs, my partner. I love the weather. Yeah, we use words to conceptualize. But when it comes to the fear of uncertainty, to bring it back full circle, most people have been conditioned to a life where they actually believe that certainty is real. And there's two things you can be led by. You can be led by your reptilian, mammalian brain, whose job is to consistently alert you to fear, because evolutionarily, what's kept us here to be able to reproduce into modern society is our ability to listen to the messages that say, oi, you shouldn't approach that snake. You shouldn't go and too far to the edge to that cliff. You should pay attention to that, that poisonous mushroom, what have you.
Nothing which is here present today in our lives.
Nothing. Yeah. So instead, that amygdala part of the brain still has a purpose. So it now, if you don't take charge of it, will look for other areas to raise warning bells in. Mortgage on Friday is due. Oh, what will that person think of me if I say this? Oh, what if my kids, have an accident at school? It's constantly feeding you what it thinks is protecting you, and really, it's destroying you. And that's where people need to understand there's a difference between fear and danger. Fear's role is to alert you to a physical danger. Once that danger has been brought into your conscious awareness, fear plays absolutely no responsibility or no, it plays no benefit. Because if you maintain the fear looking at the danger, you're going to be dumb.
Yeah. My wife says that, or said that to her kids, like, well, they said, oh, they're afraid of this, afraid of that, something in school. And she said, well, it's scary, but it's not dangerous. And that made the whole difference to them.
Brilliant.
Okay, like, oh, yeah, that's true.
Smart girl.
Yeah. She is, absolutely. And my kids was like, I'm going to die if I do this. No, you're not going to die. It's scary, but it's not dangerous. You're not going to die.
Exams can be scary.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know? But they're not dangerous.
Yeah, coming here, scary. Not dangerous. You're a friendly guy. So, but let's say, this is great. So let's say if you are an entrepreneur running your business, making good income, you got the cars, you got the house, you got the boat, you got the travels. But it needs, to maintain an extremely high amount of work. And you might have, put the focus too much into your job, and maybe the kids have almost grown up and your wife has maybe been neglected a little. And then you think, I want to maintain this, but I need to get to another level. I think you know what I'm talking about. I'm thinking, when you try to force the material world to fit your standards.
Yeah, a lot of that is a continuation of the game, chasing the more. I need more, or I link insignificance, uncertainty to having less. See, the real people that have mastered the game between chasing success, stressful, versus chasing fulfillment, understand the reality that we're not taking anything with us. The real game in town is feel great now, not feel great when.
Yeah, because maybe... This is an example from someone I know that is like, I'll only work, this long, and then I'll have enough to, you know, sell the company and then, you know, I can live great ever after. But then that doesn't happen and you have to make a shift and, you know.
And when they do, if they're in the 1% of 1% of people, entrepreneurs that actually do sell their company and retire with what they thought was financial freedom, what do they do with that financial freedom? I'll tell you what they do. They've now got enough money to pay for their divorce because they've been neglecting, as you said, their spouse. They've got enough money to hire the best, you know, physicians and personal trainers to try to get their health back they've been neglecting. Mm. And yeah, hopefully they've got enough to, in their mind, make up for all the time they lost watching their kids grow up by buying their kids loads of crap that they don't need so that they think they're a good father or what have you. And again, it could work gender both ways. I'm using the masculine here as an example. But yeah, it's the cosmic entrepreneurial joke. So understanding that, I mean, as you and I, 4 years ago, three years ago last month, I landed on this island with hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, 1 month rent in the bank, and a huge smile on my face.
How could you do that? How could you live with that amount of uncertainty, having nothing, coming to an island, and now I know what you got? How is that possible?
Your wife said there's a difference between danger and fear. Yeah, it may be scary, but it's not dangerous. Okay? Well, uncertainty or excitement? You see, there's no excitement in uncertainty.
That's true.
Right? Yeah? Yeah. You're excited at opening presents that you don't know what's under the wrapper. Mm-hmm. There's less excitement opening a present that you know what's under the wrapper. Right? The certainty and uncertainty factor is shifting your relationship to it. And again, yeah, I couldn't go any further in debt, I didn't think. And it's exciting. Let's go build something else. Let's go try something else. If I fail again, I fail again. And yeah, now, thankfully, debt-free and living a better life than I was 3 years ago. But if all that went tomorrow, it'd be a damn good excuse to play the game again. You know, if I'm playing football and you're a goal down, you don't get upset because then you go two goals down. Mm-hmm. If you get inspired and you use that goal deficit to galvanize your talent to go forward, and now we've got a game on.
That's excitement. Being now down two playing. Goals.
Now I've got a worthy opponent. Now I was caught napping and got punished for it. Or whatever you say to yourself, it's like, okay, game on. That's a different relationship to challenge than most people have that are seeking a comfort-centric experience, then wonder why their life sucks. Hmm.
So tell me a little bit about, for my audience, what you're doing now. Because I know you have a background as a personal trainer for Tony Robbins. You've been into self-development most of your life, it seems. But it seems that now you're shifting from more, you know, I guess, import, export, trade, all this material buying, selling, more into helping people fulfill themselves. That's why I'm here. I found you, been through your Elite Mentorship Forum, and nothing's the same for me. So tell me a little bit about what you're doing now.
Well, I'll clarify one thing there. I was never a personal trainer for Tony. That sounds like I was teaching him push-ups.
Okay. No.
As a trainer, I was a trainer for the Robbins Research Organization, one of Tony's elite level trainers. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that essentially meant that we were doing what you see Tony do on things like, you know, I'm not your guru. Mm. We would do on the ground with participants. Yeah, strategic intervention, leadership, human needs psychology, that kind of thing. And that gave me a really good understanding, a lot more of my passion of understanding people. But my background is traditional business, whether that's real estate, health clubs, nutraceuticals, I mean, and any kind of deal that I could look at, any crazy idea I woke up with at 3 a.m. and got excited about, I'd build a business on. And some of that, was always destined to fail spectacularly. And so, the ups and downs of entrepreneurial life, the vicissitudes of experience on that level have been, somewhat, quite wide and varied. And I'd always had that personal growth, as I said, from the age of 17 that has ran parallel. Now, in the early days of personal growth, I was using what I learned to become quote unquote successful financially, massively unfulfilled, but successful as I thought everyone else expected me to be or thought I was. And as an entrepreneur, you learn fast. I've never been bankrupt, touch wood. Come very close, come times. But I learned quite quickly in my late 20s, that money's about adding value, not about chasing wealth. And so businesses is a vehicle to generate wealth through adding value to what we call clients or customers. So I'd always focused on how can I contribute. And I ran lots of businesses, but in the background, been a passionate consumer of personal growth. I also like to teach and share what I was learning with my staff because my companies grew as a result. And my friends were sick and tired of hearing me, you know, quote Tony or George Zalecki or Zig Ziglar or Brian Tracy or any of the classics or Jim Rohn or Les Brown or several of which I've now had the pleasure of sharing the stage with. But if it comes to identity, I've always been a businessman first and an entrepreneur first and a teacher, speaker second. So it was a hobby. That shifted about 5 years ago when I realized that my passion now, it's not building businesses. I can teach people how to make money and build business in their sleep. I could do it drunk. It's not going to change the world. What changes people is what I teach now, as you've experienced. And so for me, combining my passion for business with my passion for teaching, it was natural that I would then move into a business that built that and use my business experience, for better or worse, to build a coaching, speaking, training business, rather than have it as a hobby on the side of the extra thing I did. I don't get me wrong, it was good money. I was charging $10,000 a keynote back in 2004. It was always lucrative. I did part-time coaching in 2015, made $250,000. And I don't say that try to impress people, but impress upon you the fact that, you can make this into a real business if you're passionate about helping people. And by the way, I have zero qualifications in not only school, but in coaching. I have zero courses that I've attended in public speaking. You don't need that. What you need is the conviction and the certainty that you're going to go out and add value to people. And that's what I had, because people buy people before they buy your concepts, ideas, or certificates. So for me, I was just passionate. People pick up on that. Speed of the leader, speed of the pack. I have attracted an incredible, amazing army of passionate, high conscious people into my team, my business right now. We're running, I have no idea, north of 80 plus maybe 90 staff, half of which I haven't met. And I'm so honored and grateful. People see me as the lead singer of the band. I get that. I'm the face on the camera. I'm the person in the podcasts. The work that I'm fortunate enough to re-articulate from some of the great masters in a way that people can resonate with, in the way that I share it, I'm blessed to be able to do. But there is a whole army of musicians, promoters, merchandise, as when it comes to, you take one of my heroes, Freddie Mercury, for example, in Queen. Eccentric, but people associate him as the figurehead. But Freddie Mercury didn't sell tickets to concerts. And promoters sold tickets to concerts because of Freddie Mercury. But without the promoters, there's no Queen. Yeah. So I recognize the fact, yes, I'm the lead singer of the band in many people's eyes. But there is an army of amazing, talented souls behind me that I'm privileged to be able to attract. The question is, how am I able to attract people with decades more experience than I have? Qualifications that I'd never be able to get. Because they believe in my belief in the vision. You can have a vision. It can inspire people, but nothing garners a team like the conviction the leader has in the vision. Once that conviction drops, that'll tumble downstream. So for me right now, the business that I have, 3 years later from landing here with a month's rent in the bank and hundreds of grand in debt, is down to the fact that I have a vision. It's funny, I was sharing with one of my best friends, the gentleman I'm actually going to be rowing the Atlantic with.
Afterwards, you have to tell me about that.
If we have time, Talisker Whiskey Transatlantic Challenge. You can go look it up and then decide never to do it. He was speaking to me a few months back. And he's like, Pete, I mean, where are you? And he's seen me do this several times over the years from my early time. I mean, we're childhood friends. And said, wow, look at where you're at, look at what you've done in just 3 years and where you are. He says, your journey has been incredible. He said, who'd have thought that 3 years ago, landing on the island in a dodgy old battered van that nobody would insure for breakdown, that I had to borrow, that no one thought would make the trip, to having that uncertainty of 1 month rent and seeing what would happen after that. And look at where you are now. You're in a beautiful place. You've got a beautiful life, blah, blah, blah. I said, who would have thought? I'm like, dude, what do you mean? I thought. And that's the only thing that counts. And again, this is not about me. This is about how do you reflect that back into your life. And the fact that I thought that and I knew that is why I was able to attract the people that believed in me because of my belief in the vision. Most people don't even have a vision, let alone a conviction within their ability to manifest it. But if you do and you get excited because that's your truth, not working for somebody for 30 years you don't like to get a paycheck you can't live on and a watch you know, you don't care about. But to follow that dream, that conviction, say, you know, something's great. If I lose everything tomorrow, it'd be a damn good excuse to go again. I may make it, I may not, but damn, I'm going to die trying. Not like, oh, we're two goals down at halftime, let's throw in the towel. That ain't a life you want to live. It's like, you know, something, yeah, of course it's tough. It's meant to be. Life is a growth-centric experience. When you embrace that, it changes to an exciting adventure, not a horror show or a soap opera. So having that level of conviction allowed me to build talent, because business is not a solo sport. The people in my business that do the magic, yeah, okay, I'm the dancing monkey on camera. I get that. But the people in the business that bring the magic, I'm in awe of. They're the real heroes behind me allowing me to share my gift with the world.
But one thing, if we can end with this, is you have, and it's such a broad topic, but it seems to me that the change comes when you understand that there is some force that can make things manifest that you would never thought of. Let's say things come out of left field. Somebody suddenly comes on, wants you on a business experience, or, you know, some job shows up that you had no idea coming. And it's kind of like, how can we explain to people that we actually manifest things the way we think? Because I think this is a hard concept for people to grasp, at least some. And they say, no, that's just, you know, it's woo-woo. There's nothing outside here of what I can see, and things will not just happen because I think of it.
You know? You're opening up a whole part two here.
I am. Maybe we should save that.
I'll wrap it up in a level of awareness to intrigue people to want to listen in next time. How's that? If you are blinded to the ignorance that the only thing that is physical exists, then there's not a lot we can do to help. You are limited to trying to bend physical matter reality to your will. And most people have been trying that most of their life, and good luck. And the question is, how's it working for you? The real magic happens when you realize that there is a non-physical reality that is just as real, if not more real, that science likes to ignore because they can't figure out the word consciousness. Science, material science, just think about it. What is the premise? Oh, the entire universe magicked itself out of nothing into physical matter reality, but you're not allowed to have any more miracles after that. I mean, give me a break. It's ludicrous. It's almost schizophrenic. We've known for centuries the people that own the world, those 5% that I spoke about, have been the result of the secret societies that have taught exactly what we're speaking about now, with two agendas. One, to be able to govern. And by the way, the secret societies make no secret the fact they exist. What is secret is what is taught inside. But they have produced consistently the leaders of the world, the richest people in the world. And each has a different theme. For example, the original Illuminati, which has been hijacked as a word to go into nefarious New World Order type stuff. Let's not go there. But the original Illuminati were the illuminated ones, the guardians of this level of knowledge. And they were more about raising consciousness. You take Skull and Bones at Yale University. Theirs is about wealth and power, which is why most of the US presidents have come, the richest people in the world have come out of the Brotherhood, for example. Andrew Carnegie, Ari Onassis, Henry Ford. Because they're taught how to manifest. But that also has a counterbalance of making sure that the rest of society, which up to 150 years ago was illiterate, apart from the 2% that weren't, stayed where they were. So with that level of indoctrination, if you just want to think, oh, it's all woo-woo because you don't understand the rule set that governs metaphysics, because you're too busy trying to retain your significance by pointing fingers at the rule set of the physical matter world, which we understand very well, out of originally arguably many different names, but Copernicus into Galileo into Newton was the primary path.
And now everybody's heard of quantum physics, quantum mechanics.
That's been essentially ignored as an anomaly for over 100 years since the Copenhagen meeting. And so, oh no, that doesn't fit our pictures. See, traditional science should be about, I will continually evolve my hypothesis so that it fits the consistent data. But that hasn't what's happened for 1,000 years, because, well, 100 years, sorry, because people are too attached to the significance of wanting to be right. So instead, now science is, we will ignore all of the data that doesn't fit our hypothesis. Oh, what about the magic universe? Ah, no.
But it's stuck at some point now.
You cannot suppress the direction of travel for consciousness, which is always inclined to rise. There's been a big attempt to suppress that through fear of the last couple of years by some of the remnants of the people that have come out of those societies, secret societies. But power beats force over time, every time. And I quoted that right at the start of the COVID. So, as we see now where things are at, and again, I'm not projecting my model of the world onto anybody else. You star in your own movies, ladies and gentlemen. But just be mindful that you're not being fed a script that isn't in alignment with your truth or your power to pick up the pen and write your own.
Do you see a shift now in the way the world works? It seems to spin ever more fast as we can gain more information through all the medias. And
for the vast majority of history, right up until recent times, and when I say recent, I'm talking about the last 20, 30 years, the only way you could access the kind of knowledge that we can now ask Siri for is through either, in the last 100 years, public libraries, as I said, if you had access. Prior to that, your village elder, the village scholars, your rabbi or minister, that was it. So your level of knowledge was limited to the source of knowledge. If your minister was at a certain level of consciousness, that's all they could project from. If they're at a certain level on the ladder, they can only explain the view from where they're at. So your level of interpretation of what view was possible was always limited by the people you're listening to and where they are on their own ladder. Today, that doesn't exist. You can go and learn the entire works of some of the spiritual masters at the push of a button. That's exciting times.
It is. I think we'll end it there because I know you got 150 things to do. We'll see each other again on Saturday here, I guess, at the party. And I can just invite everyone to check out. You've done probably 50 podcasts before this and you have a whole online course. So just want to say thank you, Peter. Really grateful that I had the time to talk to you and looking forward to part two.
Me too as well. It's been an absolute pleasure. Maharishi Rastar, thanks for coming over. And yes, let's get ready for an amazing weekend.
Let's do it. That was Peter Sage, ladies and gentlemen. I sincerely hope we get to sit down and do a part two someday. But if you want to learn some more, I'm going to link up to his site and YouTube. He has also done about 200 other podcasts or interviews, and some of them go 3 hours and dive deep in a lot of interesting topics. And if you're interested in learning more about the Elite Mentorship Program, EMF, get in touch with him via his site. But if you need some first-hand information, get in touch with me via mail or Instagram. I can get into details on it, and I promise this is one of the most transformative experiences you will have, regardless of your background, or if you are already an entrepreneur or just planning on becoming one. It does require some work, but not more time than you already have on your hands. The day has 24 hours, and if you skip just scrolling endlessly through the Instagram or Facebook feed, or reading news or gossip about celebrities, you'll have the time to complete this and probably change the way you approach both work and relationships in your life. I certainly have. Personally, I have changed my whole context and outlook on life, work, and relationships, and I do not experience stress or fear related to those outcomes anymore. I am a lot more easygoing, and I just feel more content and satisfied with myself and what I have.
For instance, in my life as a freelancer, I now feel relaxed and I never really stress about outcomes. I just focus on adding value for my clients. And in my running life, I have this summer run a 50K trail race and also a 50 miles race without dreading all the training on beforehand and not losing sleep over how it's going to be. I just focus on performing in the moment I'm presently in, and I was able to finish them both without a lot of extra training. The mind is very powerful if we know how to use it. And in these matters, Peter is a master. Thanks for listening, people. I love you and have an amazing day wherever you are.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.